Country Lord, meeting at the Gay Community Center.
The last of the Second Tuesday series for this season. We will be back in October. I've complained all year about all the work, and I'm feeling nostalgic already. But in spite of that, I don't have announcements about next year's guests yet. If you want to be informed of next year's series, make sure you're on our mailing list. And for people who have not been here before, we are the Lesbian and Gay Community Services Center. Thank you. This series has been a lot of work, and before we introduce our guest for the evening, I want to simply mention the people who have worked so hard to make it possible. First and foremost, Larry Josephs, Leslie Allen, that's second and foremost, Tom Mohan, Bob Berchter, Becky Jones, and the center staff. Bob, Herb Simon, Lou, all of them have really made this a very, very successful and rewarding series for us, I hope for all of you. I'm not given to long introductions, I hope, so I will just say that Audre Lorde is somebody, obviously, we all respect, that we all have responded to her work, that's why we're all here. She will be reading tonight from a new work that is about to be published, and I hope from some of her old works. I think that we've all enjoyed her essays, her journals, and most of all her poetry. And without further ado, Audre Lorde.
Thank you. You know, I greet you in my name, in the name of my mothers, in the name of my sisters, in the name of my daughters, in the name of all of us who are not here. I wanted flowers here today because this is really a celebration. I feel it as a celebration. It's a celebration of your faces. It's a celebration of this center, the existence of it here. It's a celebration because I'm happy to be alive. It's a celebration because we are sharing something that will empower all of us, slightly, somewhere. And of course, because we cannot celebrate, truly, unless we can also recognize the as Simone de Beauvoir said, the correct proportions of our lives, unless we can look at the accuracies of the lives that we are living, we cannot find the strength to change those actualities, right? Or to celebrate. And since, of course, we are celebrating, we are also, therefore, I hope, learning to use our power. And I would like to begin the reading with a poem dedicated some black South African women who I met in Europe 2 years ago. There are certain references in it. Amantha Tisi is a warrior queen. She was a leader of the Xhosa Xhosa people, right, during the greatest crisis in South African history, which was called the crushing, the Mfokane. The Xhosa people now occupy Lesotho and part of South Africa. Maseru was the scene of her greatest battle, and it is now the capital of Lesotho, which of course is a small independent country totally surrounded by South Africa. And Durban is an Indian Ocean seaport and resort area, Natal. Sisters in arms. The edge of our bed was a wide grid where your 15-year-old daughter was hanging, gut sprung on police wheels, a cablegram nailed to the wood next to a map of the Western Reserve. I could not return with you to bury the body, reconstruct your nightly cardboards against the seeping Transvaal cold. I could not plant the other limpet mine against a wall at the railroad station, nor carry either of your souls back from the river in a calabash upon my head. So I bought you a ticket to Durban on my American Express, and we lay together in the first light of a new season. Now, clearing roughage from my autumn garden, cow sorrel, overgrown rocket gone to seed, I reach for the taste of today. The New York Times finally mentions your country, a half-page story of the first white South African killed in the unrest. Not of black children massacred at Sebokeng, six-year-olds imprisoned for threatening the state, not of Thabo Sebeko, first grader, in his own blood, on his grandmother's parlor floor, Joyce, 9, trying to crawl to him, shitting through her navel. Not of a three-week-old infant, nameless, lost under the burnt beds of Tembisha. My hand comes down like a brown vice over the marigold. Reckless through despair, we were two black women touching our flame, and we left our dead behind us. I hovered, you rose, the last ritual of healing. It is spring, you whispered. I sold the ticket for guns and sulfur. I leave for home tomorrow. And wherever I touch you, I lick cold from my fingers, taste rage like salt from the lips of a woman who has killed too often to forget and carries each death in her eyes. Your mouth, a parting orchid. Someday you will come to my country and we will fight side by side. Keys jingle in the doorway ajar, threatening. Whatever is coming belongs here. I reach for your sweetness, but silence explodes like a pregnant belly into my face, a vomit of nevers. Elanthetizi turns away from the cloth her daughters-in-law are dying. The baby drools milk from her breast. She hands him, half asleep, to his sister, dresses again for war, knowing the men will follow. In the intricate Maseru twilight, quick, sad, vital, she maps the next day's battles, dreams of Durban, sometimes visions, the deep, wry song of beach pebbles running after the sea. I have... Is there water? Right behind you. Good. I spend most of my spring beachcombing in St. Croix, which has served me very well. But I've been attending with some concern and a lot of attention some developments which, although apparently feel to me to be important. One of them is a Captain Midnight. Yeah? Have you been following Captain Midnight? Renegade TV. He's been breaking into HBO, I think, and leaving certain messages. I found that really interesting because I have had this feeling for the last couple of years as I see what is happening with television, as I see the proliferation of the use of this and the abuse of it on a totally different level, even community television, community media, and I realize that the only real hope is exactly that kind of thing, right? Revolutionary TV, hit and run. I don't have the technology for it, do you see? I don't know enough on that particular way, but there is a technology, and I am very interested to see that people are beginning to use it. Right? I think we all need to take note of those things. I am interested in the next step, which is what poetry and art is about, the true subversive way of altering people's feelings. Well, if we have to use television, we can use it. I am interested in having everyone whose eyes are glued to that screen really be able to open ourselves to what it really feels like, what we are seeing. In other words, a kind of emotional holograph, right? Holograph are solid photographs that are projected. I would like to develop an emotional holography. The title of this poem is Holographs. 150 million truth seekers at the trough of the evening news. Arteries bumping and writhing against Pickbotha's belly, a keg of sound. And how does it feel to bury this baby you nursed for a year, weighing less than when she was born? 60,000 Pondo women keening over the mountain, the smell of the alley in Guguletu after burned bodies are dragged through. Penny whistles and stick drum beats earth under the high arched feet of deadly, exuberant children. Stones in their knee pants pockets, running towards Johannesburg, some singing, some waving, some stepping to intricate patterns their fathers knew. Tomorrow they will be dead. How can I mourn these children? My mothers and fathers, their sacred, generous laughter, the arms' bright marrow, willow shadows upon the stair. But young men do not dream of dying. They seek the taut sinew pulled, the passions of use, a latch slid into place. In the cold, flickering light, the only dependable warmth is the burn of the blood. The only dependable warmth is the burn of the blood. I've been doing a lot of traveling recently, and that's really interesting because, as a matter of fact, this is not a recent poem, so I've been traveling a long time. I find it very interesting the way women of all cultures find ways of coming together and at the same time doing our business, whatever our business may happen to be. And the title of this poem is Political Relations. Tashkent, as you know, is a resort area in Russia, in Uzbekistan. In a hotel in Tashkent, the Latvian delegate from Riga was sucking his fishbones as a Chukwal woman with hands as hot as mine caressed my knee beneath the dinner table. Her slanted eyes were dark as seal fur. We did not know each other's tongue. Someday, she said, someday we will talk through our children. She said, I spoke to your eyes this morning. You have such a beautiful face. And the thin-lipped Moscow girls translated for us, smirking at each other. And I had watched her in the conference hall, ox solid, black electric hair, straight as a deer's rein, fire disc eyes sweeping over the faces like a stretch of frozen tundra. We were two ends of one taut rope, stretched like a promise from her mouth singing the friendship song her people sang for greeting. There are only 14,000 of us left. It is a very sad thing. It is a very sad thing when any people dies. Yes, I heard you this morning, I said, reaching out from the place where we touched, poured her a glass of vodka, an offering which she accepted like roses, leaning across our white Russian interpreters to kiss me softly upon my lips. And then she got up and left with the Latvian delegate from Riga. Her name, as a matter of fact, was Toni. And I wonder where she is. Whenever I hear news, I wonder where she is, because her land, 14,000 of her people were left. And this was 10 years ago. But the Chukwu Peninsula, of course, is in the path of the radioactive cloud. And so I wonder where Toni is. A question of climate. I learned, to be honest, the way I learned to swim, trapped into the inevitable. My father's thumbs in my hairless armpits about to give way. And I am trying to surface carefully, open, remembering the water's shadow-legged musk, cannons of salt exploding, my nostrils rage, and how for years my powerful breaststroke was a declaration of war. Yeah. I think I will read poems instead of talking. Many of the shorter poems, I told you last year that I was very, very interested in writing shorter poems and how they worked, reclaiming that particular voice. It has partially also to do with a change I feel in my voice too. These poems for me are reassertions, are celebrations in themselves, reassertions, questions, the two sides of what we always swing between. There is no answer without a question. There is no empowerment without the recognition of vulnerability or weakness. There is no change without having been mired for a moment in the same. The title of this poem, There Are No Honest Poems About Dead Women. What do we want from each other after we have told our stories? Do we want to be healed? Do we want mossy quiet stealing over the scars? Do we want the powerful, unfrightening sister who will make the pain go away? Mother's voice in the hallway, you've done it right the first time, darling. You will never need to do it again. But thunder grumbles on the horizon. I buy time with another story, a pale blister of air, cadences of dead flesh obscure the vowels. I spent last December in a little town in Switzerland called Arlesheim. at a place called the Lucas Clinic, where I found out many, many very useful things for my own survival. It was a very strange time, though. It was very, very white in a way that was not just physical. And so it was difficult. I had to reach very, very deeply into the experience, into the place, into myself to be able to take what I needed. One of the ways that I did was to have magazines come, and one of the magazines that came was, of course, Essence. Right? Yeah. It was very interesting to see, to read Essence in that context, right? And to see some of the questions. The title of this poem comes out of that experience, and it is a question of Essence. In Orisheim, the solstice smells like hair pomade. The moon caught between warm and forever. I dream of Alice Walker, her tears on my shoulder, but I cannot see her face. Dark women painted clay pale, dash in and out of laughter, clay in their eyes, in their ears, around their noses, their tongues bedded down in clay. Some are building shelters against the past. Low huts of seductive pictures, other beautiful women. Is your hair still political? Tell me when it starts to burn. Essence, yes, hold it in. That for the record, this poem is dedicated to Eleanor Bumpers. I am glad to hear the sound of recognition, right? When I say that we celebrate not in any illusion that our celebration is either easy or that it may be forever. Right? We celebrate in the recognition, for example, that 1 year ago today, in Philadelphia, a black mayor bombed a house and killed 11 people because they were black and outrageous and black and annoying and black and black, and he was black too. 1 year ago today, and that is a reality of each of our lives here that we are not free of. Huh? That city, this city, Eleanor Bumpers, Michael Stewart, Michael Harrison last week in Queens. For the record, in memory of Eleanor Bumpers, call out the colored girls and the ones who call themselves black and the ones who hate the word nigger and the ones who are very pale. And who will count the big, fleshy women, the grandmother weighing 22 stone with the rusty braids and a gap-toothed scowl who wasn't afraid of Armageddon? The first shotgun blast tore her right arm off, the one with the butcher knife. The second blew out her heart through the back of her chest. And I am going to keep writing it down, how they carried her body out of the house, dress torn up around her waist, uncovered past tenants and the neighborhood children, a mountain of black woman. And I am going to keep telling this, if it kills me, and it might, in ways I am learning. The next day, Indira Gandhi was shot down in her garden. And I wonder, What are these two 67-year-old colored girls saying to each other now, planning their return, and they weren't even sisters? I want to tell you a little bit about how this poem came to be written. About 2 years ago, a friend of mine who was at that time a student in a workshop, we would bring in themes, brought in this theme, and we kicked it around in class and we wrote about it, but nothing really too dramatic happened for me, although it was a good learning experience. But this, the phrase would not let me sleep. So it kept running through my head and being doodled on the side of my journals for over a year. And then I got a letter from a friend, a very, very old friend, and I suddenly realized why this phrase had been running through my head. Have you ever met a person or had a relationship where you know that it had to be, not because such wonderful things came out of it, but because there were some essential lessons that each of you had to learn, right? And you just had to learn them. And so one of the lessons, of course, was how to be able to separate without killing each other. That's what, so Donna was a really good thing. The title of this poem is Making Love to Concrete. Sometimes the introduction to the poem becomes another poem. An upright abutment in the mouth of the Willis Avenue Bridge. A beige Honda leaping the divider like a steel gazelle, inescapable. Sleek leather boots on the pavement, rat-a-tat-tat. Best intentions going down for the third time, stuck in the particular. You cannot make love to concrete if you care about being non-essential, wrong or worn thin, if you fear becoming diamonds or lard. You cannot make love to concrete if you cannot pretend concrete needs your loving. To make love to concrete, you need an indelible feather and white dresses before you are 10, a communion lace veil, milk large bones, and air raid drills in your nightmare. No stars until you go to the country one summer when you are 12. Con Edison pulls the plug on the street corner moons, Walpurgisnacht, then there are sudden new lights in the sky, stone chips that forget. You need to become a light rope, a hammer, a repeatable bridge, garden fresh broccoli, a dozen dropped eggs, a hint of you caught between my fingers, the wooden beam propped up on barrels across the mind terrain between forgiving too easily and never giving at all. Yes. Traveling, moving. Moving inside, moving out. The title, Women on Trains. These are new poems, and I'm very pleased to be sharing them with you. So pleased to be sharing them with you. Women on Trains. Eleanor Roosevelt, riding the rails behind her husband's casket, forefinger tense along the propped cheek, one knuckle caressing her lips. Young Nell's dreams strung between sentinel stalks of mullein, giving in the whip of the journey's wind. My mother's mandatory hat in a no-nonsense tilt at the tenement office window, wartime, scanning Lenox Avenue for a coal delivery truck. Women on trains have a life that is exactly livable. The precision of days flashing past, no intervention allowed. The true shapes of each season, relentless, carved into the land. I have flown over crannied earth, spread like a deep woman, waiting. But the pace of this laden sky heals me through the ugliness, stacks of heat-treated lumber, and beyond the bare arms of scrub maple and poplar, already a blush like the bodies of children sleeping. Was it ever business as usual for these women? Has the snow-driven hopes and fears swirled past the office window, and nappy-topped stands of unreachable trees flowed along in the southern dusk? The coal truck arrived after dark, barely half a ton of dusty bituminous, and she had to shovel it down herself in the freezing Harlem night. Tenants, briefly appeased, coal dusted my mother's tired hat as the subway screamed us home. Women on trains have a chance to unweave our tangles. Perhaps between Blythe and Petula, Eleanor chose to live her own days. My mother never had a chance to lay her magic down. Between new lumber and the maples, I read your question, knowing I have counseled a woman badly to be who I am no longer willing to be for my living. Stopgap, hurled into the breach beyond any touch of support. I search these rushing sun-dark trees for your phone number to acknowledge both you and I are free to go. For all of us, I believe our lives, the empowerment, the work that we have to do with the power that we touch, right, gives us a strength to face what we cannot do, to face where we leave off and another cycle begins. It is a piece of what we talk about, that great big word called mortality. But to deal with it in some real way frees us and gives us another kind of power that goes into the bank, too. And the title of this poem is Never to Dream of Spiders. Time collapses between the lips of strangers. My days collapse into a hollow tube. Soon implodes against now like an iron wall. My eyes are blocked with rubble, a smear of perspectives blur each horizon. In the breathless precision of silence, one word is made. Once the renegade flesh was gone, fall air lay against my face, sharp and blue as a needle.
But the rain fell through October. Death lay a condemnation within my blood. The smell of your neck in August, a fine gold wire bejeweling war. All the rest lies, elusive as a farmhouse on the other side of a valley, vanishing in the afternoon. Day 3, day 4, day 10, the seventh step, a veiled door leading to my golden anniversary, flame-proofed free paper shredded in the teeth of a pillaging dog, never to dream of spiders. And when they turn the hoses upon me, a burst of light. I'm going to end this part of our sharing with a celebration called for strength. Call. I started out once to write a poem about the Holy Ghost because I do believe the Holy Ghost is the female part of the Trinity. Because so much of having been raised in Catholic schools, so much of the mystique around the Holy Ghost is very similar to the mystique around women, right? They're sort of hot, fiery tongued, dangerous, unformed, so forth. I started to write a poem to the Holy Ghost, and what came out was a poem to Ida Huido. Ida Huido is a Yoruba personification, the rainbow serpent. All the divinity, all the divine principles, male and female, all the goddesses and gods whose faces have been forgotten, but who nonetheless must be worshipped, and so who can only be worshipped inside of ourselves and each other. Right? So this is a poem to Ida Huido. I share it with all of you, and the title of it is Call. Holy Ghost woman, stolen out of your name, rainbow serpent whose faces have been forgotten, mother, loosen my tongue, or adorn me with a lighter burden. Ida Huido is coming. On worn kitchen stools and tables, we are piecing our weapons together, scraps of different histories. Do not let us shatter any altar. She who scrubs the Capitol toilets listening is your sister's youngest daughter, gnarled Harriet's anointed. You have not been without honor. Even the young gorilla has chosen, yells as she fires into the thicket. Ida Huido is coming. I have written your name on my cheekbones, dreamed your eyes, flesh my epiphany. Most ancient goddesses, hear me, enter. I have not forgotten your worship, nor my sisters, nor the sons of my daughters. My children watch for your print in their labors, and they say, Ida Huido is coming. I am a black woman turning, mouthing your name as a password through seductions, self-slaughter, and I believe in the Holy Ghost, mother. In your flame, beyond our vision, blown light through the fingers of women, enduring and warring, sometimes outside your name. We do not choose all our rituals. Tanding Odissi, winged girl of Soweto, brought fire back home in the snoot of a mortar, passes the word from her prison cell, whispering, Aidahuido is coming. Aidahuido is coming. Rainbow serpent, who must not go unspoken, I have offered up the safety of separations, sung the spirals of power and what fills the spaces before power unfolds or flounders in desirable non-essentials. I am a black woman stripped down and praying. My whole life has been an altar worth its ending, and I say, Aidahuido is coming. I may be a weed in the garden of women I have loved who are still trapped in their season, but even they shriek as they rip the burning gold from their skins. Aidahuido is coming. We are learning by heart what has never been taught. You are my given. Oya Sebodisa Mahu Africati, and now we are mourning our sisters. Lost to the false hush of sorrow, to hardness and hatchets and childbirth, and still we are shouting. Rosa Parks and Fannie Lou Hamer, Asata Shakur, Yah Asantewa, my mother, and Winnie Mandela are singing in my throat, the Holy Ghost's linguists, one iron silence broken. Aidahuido is calling, calling. Your daughters are named and conceiving. Mother, loosen my tongue or adorn me with a lighter burden. Aidahuido is coming. Aidahuido is coming. Aidahuido is coming.
Ask if there are questions, but first there's something I want to talk to you about, which again is about empowerment. I say that we reach for this all of our lives in order to use it. If you have gotten something from tonight, I ask that you take it, metabolize it, and use it in your living, putting yourself behind something you believe. I am a very lucky woman. I am lucky, I am blessed, because I believe that luck is a blessing. I am blessed to be able to use myself in the behind, to put myself behind what I believe, to use myself. And for those of us who are able to do that, we are in fact blessed. One of the ways in which I am using what I find has been in the anti-apartheid movement, has been very specifically about South Africa.
I am one of the members, one of six founding mothers of an organization which was originally started, which was begun in 1984 by Dr. Gloria Joseph. We, Sisterhood in Support of Sisters in South Africa, we are attempting and have so far contributed through people like yourselves over $3,000 to two women's collectives in South Africa, the Maggie Mugabe Fund and the Zimani Soweto Sisters. These are collectives that train women in Soweto and other parts of South Africa in collective work, needlework and so forth, raise funds to support children, to send them to school who are not otherwise able to go.